right? And of course you're a black marketeer. If all they sold were forks, you needed to come up with another way to find potatoes. So everyone was a black marketeer. And so when someone was saying something in politic or doing something in politic or having the wrong romance or doing or had beat you out for a job or had looked at you crosswise, you could arrest them for being a black marketeer. You never had to address the question of whether or not they were saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing. There was unlimited freedom of speech. You just had to watch what you said. And that is what we see today with selective enforcement. So, for example, everyone who uses the internet to some value of everyone is a copyright crook, right? We're all infringers. The vast majority of internet are downloaders. We use these infringing download services. It's the fastest growing technology in the history of the world. It continues to grow year on year despite lawsuits, despite arrests, despite anti-copying measures, despite more stringent penalties and so on. And it's not as though they're going to be able to sue everyone, although it seems like the recording industry is trying. They've got this new strategy they call spamigation, which is just, they've got like a boiler room that sues 700 people a month, every month, like clockwork. And, you know, at that rate, eventually they'll sue all 70 million American file sharers, and then maybe a Chase and the Miracle will return to the mall, credit card in hand. But it's that it's selectively enforced. So there's a kid at a university who maintains a piece of software called Flatland. This is a free open source search tool that looks through all the open SharePoints on the campus network, just like Google looks through all the open web servers on the public internet. And it indexes all of those files, and you can search them. So you can find all the PowerPoint slides that profs have in their SharePoints, and you can find all the term papers that people have put up for other people to refer to, the student films, the readings, and so on. You can also find all the copyrighted music and all the movies and anything else anyone cares to share, just like Google, right? If you want to find a major feature film, you don't need to be smart enough to break the anti-copying technology off of it. You need to be smart enough to go to Google and type in, say, Driving Miss Daisy space torrent, and down comes the torrent file, and you can just download it. That's how smart you need to be to get a movie. In just the same way, this was what you needed to do to get access to all these works. And so the RIAA targeted this kid because he'd written the search tool, and they wanted to make an example of him. Now, they didn't charge him with making a search tool, because making a search tool isn't illegal. They charged him with just being a downloader, because of course he was a downloader. He was an American college student. All American college students are downloaders. And what they asked for in the settlement was for him to not only pay this gigantic fine, but to promise to switch majors and stop writing software forever. Now, we actually embarrassed them out of this question, but it illustrates the point that when selective enforcement is possible, you don't have to prosecute people for the thing that they're doing. You can prosecute them for the thing that everyone does and still get them to stop the thing that they're doing. In distinguishing between the authoritarian urge and the anti-authoritarian urge as evinced by technology, we need to cleanly distinguish between those technologies that keep track of us for our own benefit and those technologies that keep track of us for someone else's benefit to be used potentially against us. So advertisers who want to track our movements through time and space, or law enforcement agents, or snoops, or identity thieves, or anyone else who wants to violate our privacy to attack us, to attack our autonomy, to attack our ability to undertake the tasks that we want to undertake. I'm glad to have technology built into my computer that spies on me for my own benefit. Like, I love it that I don't have to explicitly enter into my address book all of the people I want to correspond with. Every time I reply to an email, that person is added to my address book. That's great that my email spies on my habits and gets smarter based on them. Or that my browser remembers all the web pages I've been to recently and auto-completes forms when I fill them in. And I even like those tools that kind of sit between the controlling you and assisting you, those ones that live out on the network like Last.fm or Amazon's People Who Bought This Also Bought That. But I think that as the national security apparatus of the world go bonkers and start rolling around like toddlers having tantrums, smashing everything within reach, it behooves us, we who design these applications, to not leave this personal data within reach, to start designing these applications to run mostly on your own computer, to take the smallest quantum of data that you need to do that comparison, to add that benefit, and to put it on the server, and then to remove it as quickly as is humanly possible, to never copy that which you don't need, and to selectively copy only that which you do need. But we also need to distinguish between those technologies and the technologies that have no purpose but to spy on you. The ability for machines to add us up is greater than it's ever been. Take the radio frequency ID tag. If you have a pass to get into this building, chances are it has a radio frequency ID tag in it. Or if you have a toll pass, it has a radio frequency ID tag. These are little tags, or a whole class of little machines that emit a beacon that has a serial number on it, a unique serial number that's readable by radio receivers, that specifies exactly which card is where, which radio frequency ID tag is where. So as you pass by a reader, it can read it. This is how those toll passes work. This is how your touchless library card works and your transit pass and so on. And the theory is that these can only be read at a close distance, you know, a few centimeters. And that's sort of true, right? The thing is that a large class of these can only be read when they're excited with radio energy, and radio energy attenuates the square of distance. So it kind of drops off very, very quickly. And so you need to be pretty close to it to bombard it with enough energy to make it wake up. And if you try to do it from a greater distance, you have to put so much radio energy into free space that like passing birds start to drop out of the sky. So you can notice when people are exciting it. But the problem is that we are now surrounded by RFID readers. The more RFID tags we use, the more places there are where there are readers. And when the reader excites the tag, you can read the tag from a distance. It's not the reading the tag that's hard, it's the exciting of the tag that's hard. And so what you need to do is just set up camp some other place that's line of sight to a reader, and as people walk by it, you snipe the tags one after another. Well, who cares if they just get your serial number? After all, what good is that? Well, what good that is that after the fact, after you've left this data trail behind you, this smog of information, it can be turned against you, because once someone correlates that number with you because they've arrested you and they want to find out what your movements have been, or because they got a picture of you as you were walking past when they read your tag, or through some other mechanism, they can suddenly track all of those movements. They can put a face to all those names, or a name to all of those faces, to all of those numbers, and suddenly they know all the places that you've been. You have this post-facto identification. We have entered an era of continuous, non-stop identification. Right? We are now not only carrying identity papers, but carrying identity papers that can be read without our knowledge and even against our will. And this starts, ironically, with a technology of liberation. Right? We think of the automobile, the golden age of the automobile, as being an age of youth liberation. Right? For the first time, kids could get away from their parents, the sexual revolution and the drive-in and all of that stuff followed from it. But it's also the moment at which young people routinely begin carrying identity papers in the form of driving licenses. And it's been all downhill from there. The number of contexts in which you are required to identify yourself just increase and increase and increase. It's an attractive nuisance. It's like Chekhov says, when there's a gun on the mantelpiece in Act 1, it'll go off by Act 3. If you're carrying an identity paper in your wallet, someone will find a reason to make you look at it, to make it, you show it to them. And not only do we have the danger of being individual identified, but we have the danger of being correlated with other identification, of being found guilty by association, or of having inferences drawn about our behavior and our deeds. So I was at the Computer Freedom and Privacy Conference a couple of years ago in Seattle, and some hackers from the Shmoo Group set up Bluetooth readers. Bluetooth is another one of these beacon technologies that can be read without your knowledge and even against your will, all through the conference space. And at the end of the conference, they did a little presentation for us with overheads, and they said, this group of people know each other. This group of people always leave sessions early. These people are smokers. They've been downstairs. These people spent the whole conference in the bar. Right? And they knew it. They knew it because they could correlate it. And again, six lines in any man's hand will find you a reason to hang him. If one of those people turns out to be a bad guy, what does it mean that all the rest of you can be identified as his close confederate? Not only that, but these things are trivially cloned, and I talked about that at the start of this talk, this paper from Usenix Lisa, that it turns out to be really easy to make copies of them. But almost no one who's in a position of authority will believe it. So the fact that your RFID was read becomes incontrovertible evidence of the fact that you were somewhere, even if you weren't. Now, at the heart of an RFID is something called a globally unique identifier, or GUID. GUIDs have all the risks of RFIDs and more. You might think of your social insurance number as an example of your GUID. It's a unique identifier, and it's only supposed to be used in small contexts, right? The context of assessing how much money you owe the tax man. But as you know, as soon as you have a GUID on your person, the mission starts to creep for it. Everyone wants to use the GUID to identify you in multiple databases so that those databases can be merged and compared. And so now, everywhere you go, someone's got their hand out asking you for your social insurance number. Now, there's an even more pernicious form of GWID, and it's the biometric GWID, right? Your retina, your fingerprint, your hand geometry, your gait, your face. If you want to go back in time, the bumps on your head, for those phrenologists in the crowd. And biometrics have all the dangers of GWIDs, and the additional danger that they can't be recalled. So say your social insurance number leaks, and it turns out that there are 50 people who are presently holding down minimum wage jobs across the country that are all using your social insurance number. You can always get another social insurance number. Sure, you'll be untangling it for years, but at least you can get another social insurance number. Now, people have defeated fingerprint readers with gummy bears, right? So what happens when your fingerprint leaks? What happens when all across the country people are using your fingerprint to get into cars, to get into trouble, to get into theaters, to get into secure places, and do bad stuff? How do you recall your fingerprints, short of taking the paper cutter in the office room and getting rid of them altogether? And the other thing about a biometric is that about 5% of the population, about 1 in 20 people, can't use any biometric that you care to name, either because they're missing a body part, a fingertip, or just have scars on their fingers, or because they have had some accident of luck, some raw luck element that causes their particular biometric to just not be amenable to being read by computers. Right? Software doesn't make an actual copy of your fingerprint. It tries to find some salient pieces of your fingerprint and copy those. And if you don't have those pieces, if you're just not in the three signals away from normal that the software designers anticipated, your fingerprint can't be read. And all of a sudden, you're the person who's in that very long queue of people who have something wrong with them. And what you have wrong with them is that you just don't have the right biometric. You've become a second-class citizen because you don't have the right biometric. These biometrics, these GWIDs, these RFIDs, they condition us to live in a surveillance state. They condition us to be treated like criminals and like it. I went to Disney World for Christmas, and at the turnstiles at Walt Disney World now, they're fingerprinting people, and they're searching your bags as you go in. And as we were crossing through, and we discovered that you didn't have to agree to be fingerprinted, and they say, oh, it's not fingerprinting, we're only measuring the unique characteristics of your fingertip. Very fine distinction, right? And it turns out that you can choose to show photo ID, because of course you wouldn't want to be anonymously admitted into a theme park. What was I thinking? You can show photo ID instead. But of course, like all of these exceptional cases, no one knows that that's the rule. So every time, it was a little social experiment of ours, because we're perverse that way. Every time we went through the turnstile, we showed our ID, increasingly baroque pieces of ID, my student card, my scuba diving card, my library card, and so on, to get in. And every time, the person working the turnstile would say, I'm sorry, you have to be fingerprinted, and we'd have a little discussion. It was a little teaching moment, you know, pedagogy on holiday. And I am that much of a pain in the ass. So we're there, and we're arguing with the guy at the turnstile. You have to be fingerprinted. We don't have to be fingerprinted. You do have to be fingerprinted. You don't have to be fingerprinted. There's a 10-year-old behind us who says, yes, you do. Everyone has to be fingerprinted. And that's when it hit me. We used to worry that Disney was conditioning our little girls to want to grow up and be princesses. We used to worry that Disney was conditioning our little boys to want to grow up and be, all-American football players. Now I worry that Disney is conditioning our children to want to grow up and live in Gulag America, right? To be willing citizens of a surveillance state where they are searched and identified without particularized suspicion against their will all the time. So in addition to these problems of active identification, there's another problem that computers make possible and that informs the ideology of control, and that's the future, the prospective revelation. So I mentioned Usenet, and in the early days of Usenet, none of us suspected that Usenet was being archived. We all thought that it was a book written on water, and it would just disappear as soon as we'd written the post. It would just vanish, scroll off the screen. And so, of course, these were college kids mostly using Usenet, and they would every day write their personal revelations, kind of, you know, Facebook, but earlier, paleo Facebook. So you'd have the kid who would go, wow, I can't believe how deep I got in the K-hole at Woodstock 99, and think nothing of it until Deja News came out, which put the entire Usenet archive back online and made it fully searchable. And suddenly, some of those kids were having their IPOs. And, you know, the Red Herring could run a cover story that said, meet the K-hole CEO, are drug takers taking over America's boardrooms, right? Suddenly, all of that stuff was subject to interrogation, even though you never knew that it would appear again. And I think we're headed for another one of these. That's with face recognition software, which is getting better and better because casinos and law enforcement and anyone else who and sportsbook places and the Olympics and airports, they all want to recognize your face as you move through time and space, find all the bad guys with software. So right now we rely on those photos of ourselves as being anonymous if they don't have our name on them. So we don't mind that our name is on that photo of us at the big football game, that photo of us on holiday, and that photo of us partying with our friends. But we're really glad that it's not on that photo of us at our diaper fetish party, right? So face recognition software comes along, and the first thing that happens is someone makes a copy of all the pictures on the internet, the way Google does. The second thing that happens is that someone then finds all the photos that are of the same person, right? So these are all photos of that guy. And then they find one of those photos that has a label. And then they know who all of those photos are of. And we're headed for another one of these giant data Valdezes, where all of that information is suddenly going to be publicly available. So we are sleepwalking into a surveillance state. All around us, we find ourselves surrounded by CCTV cameras, surrounded by technologies for surveillance. I just read a little note from your local security department here on campus advising us that if you are worried about the CCTVs, you shouldn't worry. It's just like having a friendly policeman around, except it's just the opposite. It's the opposite of having a policeman around. A policeman is there to intervene and to be part of the community. A CCTV camera is there to merely record and subsequently punish wrongdoers. Wrongdoers who are so out of their minds that they're willing to make bad judgment decisions like mugging you, right? So what CCTVs stop are the muggers who have bad enough judgment to mug you but good enough judgment not to do it in front of a camera. And that turns out to only be a small set of the muggers and not necessarily the ones that we're worried about. And I have a friend who was murdered on his doorstep in London by three people who were captured on CCTV as they were leaving the tube. And he was killed for his mobile phone. Now, people who are in possession of such poor judgment that they're murdering people for their mobile phones are not of such good judgment that they worry about CCTVs. The tube station that he left didn't have a guard on duty. They had replaced the guard with a CCTV camera. And so they were able to catch these kids subsequently, but my friend is still dead. We have metal detectors in schools and clubs. We've given parents the tools to follow their children around on MySpace and in the real space. The new Disney phone tracks your child as he moves through time and space. We've created the world's most surveyed generation. And we're not being made safer by it. We have the right to be secure and private, and it's not abrogated by technology. Technology can serve us or enslave us. Ultimately, it's our own choice. We can be Luddites and saboteurs. We can be refuseniks, and we can refuse to be identified. We can run Tor nodes. Tor is this thing called the Onion Router that anonymizes your traffic and other people's traffic and helps people be anonymous on the internet. It's, if you go to tor.eff.org, you can find out more information. It was created by the American Office of Naval Intelligence to help people communicate outside of repressive regimes like Syria and so on. But now, of course, it's widely deployed in corporations and high schools and the bedrooms of the world because we're all laboring under the same kind of surveillance state. And I'm proud to say that Boing Boing, the website I co-edit, our servers are located in Toronto, and they're Tor nodes. And we route lots of traffic for people who want to get lost in the crowd. You can use strong cryptography. We have at our fingertips now tools to encrypt our email, tools to encrypt our messages, tools to encrypt our web pages so that they can't be read in transit. And even if you have nothing to hide, by encrypting your web pages, you help everyone else who's looking at the internet stay secret. Because if it turns out that you're the only person keeping secrets, you become the subject of suspicion. They don't need to know that you're doing something wrong. They merely need to know that you're doing something different to target you for suspicion. You can join organizations like Free Culture, a global campus movement to support freedom of expression, freedom of thought, and freedom of action. And the Electronic Frontier Foundation, whose Canadian chapter is called ORC, the Online Rights of Canada, the best acronym ever. And you can join up with ORC, and you can work to support a freer and better Canada. You can refuse to click on those I agree end user license agreements in which you agree to waive all of the rights that we've managed to win in our government And you can fight back. I have a little thing. If you go to reasonableagreement.org, you'll find my version of this, which says, by reading this, you agree to release me from all the agreements that I've entered into with your employer, and you further agree that you have the right to do so. Thank you for agreeing. And so you can put this at the bottom of your email. You can write it at the bottom of your credit card stubs. And you can start to make fun of this. We can start highlighting this. We can stop giving companies a walk on this. Because these days, companies do it. We go, oh, everyone's doing it. Why should we worry about it? But every time there's a privacy Valdez, every time someone does something bad to their customers, they always fall back on these agreements. And finally, there's an amazing petition going around at digitalcopyright.ca. And this is a copyright to petition for fair dealing rights for Canadians and to keep us from being spied on by our own computers and from giving legal protection to software that spies on us and that controls our computers against our will, what's called digital rights management technology. And if you go there, you can sign that petition too. So I guess I'm out of time. Thank you all very much for sitting so patiently, and I hope you have a great day.
That was Cory Doctorow, activist, journalist, and science fiction author who serves as co-editor of the blog, Boing Boing. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. And now for our next installment from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. We'll resume with our reading from Chapter 13, titled The Empty Child, that deals with the techniques of behaviorist psychology as they came to be applied within the system of American compulsory schooling. To say that various psychologies dominate modern schooling is hardly to plow new ground. The tough thing to do is show how that happened and why, and how the project progresses to its unseen goals. The Atlantic Monthly had this to say in April 1993, quote, "Schools have turned to therapeutic remediation. A growing proportion of many school budgets is devoted to counseling and other psychological services. The curriculum is becoming more therapeutic. Children are taking courses in self-esteem, conflict resolution, and aggression management. Parental advisory groups are conscientiously debating alternative approaches to traditional school discipline, ranging from teacher training in mediation to the introduction of metal detectors and security guards in the schools. Schools are increasingly becoming emergency rooms of the emotions, devoted to repairing hearts. What we are seeing is the psychologization of American education." Close quote. 2 years before I ran across that Atlantic broadside, I encountered a different analysis in the financial magazine Forbes. I was surprised to discover Forbes had correctly tracked the closest inspiration for school psychologizing, both its aims and its techniques, to the pedagogy of China and the Soviet Union. Not similar practices and programs, mind you, identical ones. The great initial link with Russia I knew had been from the Wundtian Ivan Pavlov, but the Chinese connection was news to me. I had been unaware then of John Dewey's tenure there in the 1920s and had given no thought for that reason to its possible significance. Quote, "The techniques of brainwashing developed in totalitarian countries are routinely used in psychological conditioning programs imposed on school children. These include emotional shock and desensitization, psychological isolation from sources of support, stripping away defenses, manipulative cross-examination of the individual's moral values by psychological rather than rational means. These techniques are not confined to separate courses or programs. They are not isolated idiosyncrasies of particular teachers. They are the products of numerous books and other educational materials in programs packaged by organizations that sell such curricula to administrators and teach the techniques to teachers. Some packages even include instructions on how to deal with parents and others who object. Stripping away psychological defenses can be done through assignments to keep diaries to be discussed in group sessions, through role-playing assignments, both techniques used in the original brainwashing programs in China under Mao, close quote. The Forbes writer Thomas Sowell, perhaps invoking the slave states in part to rouse the reader's capitalist dander, could hardly have been aware himself how carefully industrial and institutional interest had seeded Russia, China, Japan, and the Pacific Islands with the doctrine of psychological schooling long ago, nearly at the beginning of the century, and in Japan's case, even before that. All along, we have harvested these experimental growths in foreign soil for what they seem to prove about people shaping. For example, the current push for school to work mines deep specific practices of the former Soviet Union, even to the point of using identical language from Soviet texts. School to work was a project installed in Russia by Americans in the 1920s to test the advice of the 19th century Swiss aristocrat von Fellenberg that manual labor should be combined with academic schooling. Fellenberg's doctrine was a short-lived fad in this country in the 1830s, but ever after it had a place in the mind of certain men of affairs and social theorists. The opportunity afforded by Russia's chaos after World War I seemed too promising to pass up. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. The Great Four Schooling Plan, even long ago, was a global movement. Anatomizing its full scope is well beyond my power, but I can open your eyes part way to this poorly understood dimension of our pedagogy. Think of China, the Asian giant, so prominently fixed now in headline news. Its revolution, which ended the rule of emperors and empresses, was conceived, planned, and paid for by Western money and intellectuals, and by representatives of prominent families of business, media, and finance, who followed the green flag of commerce there. This is a story abundantly related by others, but less well known, is the role of ambitious Western ideologues like Bertrand Russell, who assumed a professorship at the University of Peking in 1920, and John Dewey, who lived there for 2 years during the 1920s. Men like this saw a chance to paint on a vast blank canvas, as Cecil Rhodes had shown somewhat earlier in Africa, could be done by only a bare handful of men. Listen to an early stage of the plan taken from a Columbia Teachers College text written in 1931. The author is John Childs, rising academic star, friend of Dewey. The book, Education and the Philosophy of Experimentalism, quote, "During the World War, a brilliant group of young Chinese thinkers launched a movement which soon became nationwide in its influence. This movement was called in Chinese the Xin Zhu Chao, which literally translated New Thought Tide. Because many features of New Thought Tide were similar to those of the earlier European Awakening, it became popularly known in English as the Chinese Renaissance. While the sources of this intellectual and social movement were various, it is undoubtedly true that some of its most able leaders had been influenced profoundly by the ideas of John Dewey. They found intellectual tools almost ideally suited to their purposes in Dewey's philosophy. Among these tools, his view of the instrumental character of thought, his demand that all tradition, beliefs, institutions be tested continuously by their capacity to meet contemporary human needs, and his faith that the wholehearted use of experimental attitude and method would achieve results in the social field similar to those already secured in the field of natural sciences," close quote. At about the time of the close of the World War, Dewey visited China. For 2 years, through lectures, writing, and teaching, he gave in-person powerful reinforcement to the work of the Chinese Renaissance leaders. It's sobering to think of sad-eyed John Dewey as the godfather of Maoist China, but that he certainly was. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Dewey's experimentalism represented a new faith which was swallowed whole in Watson's behaviorism. According to Childs, the unavowed aim of the triumphant psychology was, quote, to abolish thinking, at least for the many, for if thinking were possible, the few could do it for the rest, close quote. For Dewey, as for the behaviorists, the notion of purpose was peculiarly suspect, since the concept of conditioning seemed to obsolete the more romantic term. A psychological science born of physics was sufficient to explain everything. The only utopia behaviorism allowed was one in which the gathering of facts, statistical processing, and action based on research was allowed. It is tempting to bash or worship Dewey for high crimes or high saintliness, depending on one's politics. But a greater insight into the larger social process at work can be gained by considering him an emblem of a new class of hired gun in America, the university intellectual whose prominence comes from a supposed independence and purity of motive, but who simultaneously exists most often unwittingly as the protege, mouthpiece, and disguise for more powerful wills than his own. Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski are prime examples of the type in our own day. Dewey was determined his experimental subjects would be brought in to actively participate in the ongoing experiments, not necessarily with their knowledge. All education was aimed at directing the responses of children. Orwell is really satirizing Deweyists and Fabianisms in his post-World War II dystopian nightmare, 1984, when Winston Smith's execution is delayed until he can be brought to denounce the people he loves and to transfer his love to Big Brother. In Dewey's world, this is only bringing Smith into active participation. That it is in his own degradation is final proof that private purposes have been surrendered and the conditioning is complete. We reject completely the hypothesis of choice. We consider the traditional doctrine of free will to be both intellectually untenable and practically undesirable, is the way Child translates Dewey. The new systems theorists, experimentalists, and behaviorists are all Wundt's children in regarding human life as a mechanical phenomenon, but they are polemicists too. Notice Child's hint that even if free will were intellectually tenable, it would only cause trouble. The great energy that drives modern schooling owes much to a current of influence arising out of the psychology laboratory of Wilhelm Wundt at the University of Leipzig in Saxony. With a stream of international assistance, Wundt set out to examine how the human machine was best adjusted. By 1880, he'd laid the basis for Pavlov's work and the work of Watson in America, for the medical procedure of lobotomy, for electroshock therapy, and for the scientific view that school was a ground for social training, socialization in John Dewey's terminology. Among Wundt's principal assistants was the flamboyant American G. Stanley Hall, who organized the psychology lab at Johns Hopkins in 1887, established the American Journal of Psychology, and saw to it that Sigmund Freud was brought to America for a debut here. Stanley Hall's own star pupil at Hopkins was the Vermonter John Dewey. Wundt's first assistant, James McKean Cattell, was also an American, eventually the patron saint of psychological testing here. He was also the chief promoter of something called the sight reading method, the dreadful fallout from which helped change the direction of American society. Cattell was the first professor of psychology so titled in all the world, reigning at the University of Pennsylvania. In 1894, he founded the Psychological Review. Over the next 25 years, he trained 344 doctoral candidates. In these stories, and many others like them, the influence of Wundt and Prussia multiplied. Cattell later created the reference books Leaders in Education, American Men of Science, and The Directory of American Scholars, and for good measure founded Popular Science, all of which boosted the stock of the infant discipline. Other Wundtian PhDs in the United States included James Baldwin, who set up the Psych Lab at Princeton, Andrew Armstrong, who did the same at Wesleyan, Charles Judd, who became the Director of Education at the University of Chicago, and James Earl Russell, president of Teachers College at Columbia. There were many others. Russell's Teachers College, the Rockefeller-sponsored, Prussian-inspired seminary on 120th Street in New York City, had a long reign dominating American pedagogy. By 1950, it had processed an unbelievable one-third of all presidents of teacher training institutions, one-fifth of all American public school teachers, one-quarter of all superintendents. Thus, the influence of Prussian thought dominated American school policy at a high level by 1914, and the Prussian tincture was virtually universal by 1930. Some parts of the country were more resistant to the dumbing down of curriculum and the psycho-socializing of the classroom than others. But by the process of attrition, Prussianization gained important beachheads year by year through private foundation projects, textbook publishing, supervisory associations, and on through every aspect of school. The psychological manipulation of the child suggested by Plato had been investigated by Locke, raised to clinical status by Rousseau, refined into materialist method by Helvetius and Herbart, justified philosophically as the essential religion by Comte, and scientized by Wundt. One does not educate machines, one adjusts them. This peculiar undertaking of educational psychology was begun by Edward Thorndike of Teachers College in 1903. Thorndike, whose once famous puzzle box became the Skinner box of later behavioral psychology after minor modifications, was a protege of Wundtians Judd and Armstrong at Wesleyan, taking his Ph.D. under Wundtian Cattell before being offered a post by Wundtian Russell at Teachers College. According to Thorndike, the aim of a teacher is to produce and prevent certain responses, and the purpose of education is to promote, quote, adjustment. In Elementary Principles of Education, he urged the deconstruction of emphasis on intellectual resources for the young, advice that was largely taken. It was bad advice, in light of modern brain research suggesting direct ties between the size and complexity of the brain and strenuous thought grappled with early on. Thorndike said intelligence was virtually set at birth. Real change was impossible. A scientific pronouncement which helped to justify putting the brakes on ambitious curricula. But in the vitally important behavioral area, in beliefs, attitudes, and loyalties, Thorndike did not disappoint the empty child crowd. In those areas so important to corporate and government health, children were to be as malleable as anyone could want them. An early ranking of school kids by intelligence would allow them to be separated into tracks for behavioral processing. Thorndike soon became a driving force in the growth of national testing, a new institution which would have consigned Benjamin Franklin and Andrew Carnegie to reform school and Edison to special education. Even before we got the actual test, Thorndike became a significant political ally of the semi-covert sterilization campaign taking place in America. That pioneering eugenic program seemed socially beneficial to those casually aware of it, and it was enthusiastically championed by some genuine American legends, like Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. But if you find yourself nodding in agreement that morons have no business with babies, you might want to consider that according to Thorndike's fellow psychologist H.H. Goddard at Princeton, 83% of all Jews and 79% of all Italians were in the mental defective class. The real difficulty with scientific psychology or other scientific social science is that it seems able to produce proof of anything on command. Convincing proof, too, delivered by sincere men and women, just trying to get along by going along. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. William James wrote in 1879, "Wundt aims on being a Napoleon. Unfortunately, he will never have a Waterloo. Cut him up like a worm, and each fragment crawls. You can't kill him." Close quote. From his laboratory in Upper Saxony near the Prussian border, Wundt wrote 53,735 published pages in the 68 years between 1853 and 1920, words which sculpted modern schooling from a disorderly attempt to heighten human promise in individuals or to glorify God's creation into mandated psychological indoctrination. Wundt's childhood was unrelieved by fun. He never played. He had no friends. He failed to find love in his family. From this austere forge, a PhD emerged humorless, indefatigable, and aggressive. At his end, he returned to the earth childless. Wundt is the senior psychologist in the history of psychology, says Boring. Quote, "Before him, there was psychology, but no psychologists, only philosophers." Close quote. Coming out of the psychological tradition of psychophysics in Germany, Wundt followed the path of de la Mettrie, Condillac, and Descartes in France, who argued, each in his own way, that what we think of as personality is only a collection of physiological facts. Humanity is an illusion. Wundt had a huge advantage over the mechanists before him. For him, the time was right. All religious and romantic opposition and disarray, bewildered by the rapid onset of machinery into society. Over in England, Darwin's brilliant cousin, Francis Galton, was vigorously promoting mathematical prediction into the status of a successful cult. In one decade, bastions of a more ancient scholarly edifice were overrun by number crunchers. A bleak future suddenly loomed for men who remained unconvinced that any transcendental power was locked up in quantification of nature and humankind. The Pythagorean Brotherhood was reseating itself inexorably in this great age of Wundt. The two in harmony, as both contributed heavily to the centralization of things and to the tidal wave of scientific racism which drowned the university world for decades, culminating in the racial science station maintained on the old Astor estate in Cold Spring Harbor, Long Island, by Carnegie interests, until the events of September 1939 caused it to quietly close its doors. Even at the beginning of the marriage of scholarship and statistics, its principals saw little need to broaden their investigations into real life, an ominous foreshadowing of the eugenical outlook that followed. A friendless, loveless, childless male German calling himself a psychologist set out, I think, to prove his human condition didn't matter because feelings were only an aberration. His premises and methodology were imported into an expanding American system of child confinement, and through that system disseminated to administrators, teachers, counselors, collegians, and the national consciousness. As Germany became the intellectual's darling of the moment at the end of the 19th century, a long-dead German philosopher, Kant's successor at the University of Berlin, Johann Herbart, enjoyed a vogue in school-intoxicated America. Her Bartianism is probably the first of a long line of pseudoscientific enthusiasms to sweep the halls of pedagogy. A good German, Herbart laid out with precision the famous Herbartian five-step program, not a dance, but a psychologized teacher training program. By 1895, there was a national Herbartian society to spread the good news, enrolling the likes of Nicholas Murray Butler of Columbia and John Dewey. Herbart was finally laid to rest sometime before World War I when Dewey's interest cooled. But his passage was a harbinger of many Herbart-oid enthusiasms to follow as a regular procession of educational gurus rose and fell with the fashion of the moment. The Moorish dance of scientific pedagogy accelerated its tempo relentlessly, and arms, legs, heads, perspiration, cries of venereal delight and some anguish too, mingled in the hypnotic whirl of laboratory dervishes. By 1910, Dewey was substituting his own five steps for Herbart's in a book called How We Think. Few who read it noticed that a case was being made that we don't actually think at all. Thinking was only an elusive kind of problem-solving behavior, called into being by dedicated activity. Otherwise, we are mindless. What we today call the science of child development grew out of the ambition of G. Stanley Hall, Wundt's first assistant at Leipzig, Dewey's mentor at Hopkins, and a man with a titanic ego. Hall inserted the word adolescence into the American vocabulary in 1904. If you wonder what happened to this class before they were so labeled, you can reflect on the experience of Washington, Franklin, Farragut, and Carnegie, who couldn't spare the time to be children any longer than necessary. Hall, a fantastic pitchman, laid the groundwork for a host of special disciplines, from child development to mental testing. Hall told all who listened that the education of the child was the most important task of the race, our primary mission, and the new science of psychology could swiftly transform the race into what it should be. Hall may have never done a single worthwhile scientific experiment in his life, but he understood that Americans could be sold a sizzle without the steak. Thanks in large measure to Hall's trumpet, an edifice of child development rose out of the funding of psychological laboratories in the early 1900s during the famous Red Scare period. In 1924, the Child Welfare Institute opened at Teachers College, underwritten by the Rockefeller Foundation. Another was opened in 1927 at the University of California. Generous donations for the study of all phases of child growth and development poured into the hands of researchers from the largest foundations. 35 years later, during what might be thought of as the nation's fourth Red Scare, the moment the Soviets beat America into space, the U.S. Education Office presided over a comprehensive infiltration of teacher training in schools. Judiciously applied funds and arm twisting made certain these staging areas would pay proper attention to the psychological aspect of schooling. Dewey, Hall, Thorndike, Cattell, Goddard, Russell, and all the other intellectual stepchildren of Wundt and the homeless mind he stood for set out to change the conception of what constitutes education. They got powerful assistance from great industrial foundations and their house universities like Teachers College. Under the direction of James Earl Russell, president and head of the psychology department, Teachers College came to boast training where, quote, psychology stands first. Wherever Columbia graduates went, this view went with them. The brand new profession of psychiatry flocked the banner of this new philosophy of psychological indoctrination as a proper government activity. Perhaps sensing that business and status could flow from the connection if it were authoritatively established, in 1927, Ralph Truett, head of the then embryonic Division of Child Guidance Clinics for the Psychiatric Association, wrote that, quote, school should be the focus of the attack, close quote. The White House appeared in the picture like a guardian angel watching over the efforts this frail infant was making to stand. In 1930, 1,200 child development, quote, experts were invited to the White House Conference on Child Health and Protection, an event with no precedent. One primary focus of attendees was the role failure played as a principal source of children's problems. The echo of Rousseau was unmistakable. No attempt was made to examine how regularly prominent Americans, like Washington, or successful businessmen like Carnegie, had surmounted early failure. Instead, a plan to eliminate failure structurally from formal schooling was considered and endorsed. Failure could be eliminated if schools were converted into laboratories of life adjustment and intellectual standards were muted. By 1948, the concept of a collective as opposed to individual mental health was introduced at an international meeting in Britain to discuss the use of schools as an instrument to promote mental health. But what was mental health? What did a fully sane man or woman look like? Out of this conference in the UK, two psychiatrists, J.R. Rees and G. Brock Chisholm, leveraged a new profitable organization for themselves, the World Federation for Mental Health. It claimed expertise in preventative measures and pinpointed the training of children as the proper point of attack. Quote, "The training of children is making 1,000 neurotics for every one psychiatrist can hope to help with psychotherapy." Chisholm knew what caused the problem in childhood. He knew how to fix it, too. Quote, "The only lowest common denominator of all civilizations and the only psychological force capable of producing these perversions is morality, the concept of right and wrong." Close quote. Shakespeare and the Vikings had been right. There's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Morality was the problem. With World War II behind us and everything adrift, a perfect opportunity to rebuild social life in school and elsewhere on a new amoral scientific logic was presenting itself. Quote, "We have swallowed all manner of poisonous certainties fed us by our parents, our Sunday and day school teachers, our politicians, our priests, our newspapers. The results, the inevitable results, are frustration, inferiority, neurosis, and inability to enjoy living. If the race is to be freed from its crippling burden of good and evil, it must be psychiatrists who take the original responsibility." Close quote. Old Norse pragmatism, the philosophy most likely to succeed among upper crust thinkers in the northeastern United States, was reasserting itself as global psychiatry. The next advance in pedagogy was the initiative of a newly formed governmental body, the National Institutes of Mental Health, NIMH. In 1950, it arranged the White House Conference on Education to warn that a psychological time bomb was ticking inside the schools. An epidemic of mental insufficiency was said to be loose among Americans, imperiling the advances that industry and the arts had given America. Barbarians were already through the gates and among us. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. And just as an aside, some of this same period and issues is also picked up in the Power of Nightmares documentary series, which was adapted for radio and aired on some earlier episodes of this show and is available in our archives at unwelcomeguests.org. Twice before, attempts had been made to tell the story of an Armageddon ahead if the government penny-pinched on the funding of psychological services. First was the great feeble-mindedness panic, which preceded and spanned the World War I period. Word spread from academic centers that feeble-mindedness was rampant among Americans. The moron, imbecile, and idiot insults, which ricocheted around my elementary school in the early 1940s, were one of the legacy of this premature marketing campaign. During World War II, the drive to convince keepers of the purse that the general population was a body needing permanent care was helped powerfully by a diffusion of British Psychological Warfare Bureau reports that the majority of common British soldiers were mentally deficient. Now that notion and its implied corrective, buying protection from psychologists, made inroads on American managerial consciousness, producing monies to further study the retarded contingent among us. Reading the text, Proceedings of the Mid-Century White House Conference on Children and Youth, we learn that school has, quote, responsibility to detect mental disabilities which have escaped parental or preschool observation. Another huge duty it had was the need to, quote, initiate all necessary health services through various agencies. Still another to, quote, provide counseling services for all individuals at all age levels. The classic line in the massive entire document is, not only does the child need to be treated, but those around him also need help. A hospital society was needed to care for all the morons, idiots, and mental defectives science had discovered lurking among the sane. It would need school as its diagnostic clinic and principal referral service. Western religious teaching that nobody can escape personal responsibility was chased from the field by Wundt's minimalist outlook on human nature as mechanism. A complex process was then set in motion which could not fail to need forced instruction to complete itself. The NIMH used the deliberations of the 1950 conference to secure government funding for an enormous 5-year study of the mental health of the nation, a study conducted by the very people whose careers would be enhanced by any official determination that the nation faced grave problems from its morons and other defectives. Can you guess what the final document said? Action for Mental Health proposed that school curriculum, quote, be designed to bend the student to the realities of society, close quote. It should be, quote, designed to promote mental health as an instrument for social progress, close quote, and as a means of altering culture. What factors inhibit mental health that are directly in the hands of school authorities to change? Just these. Expectations that children should be held responsible for their actions, expectations that it is important for all children to develop intelligence, the misperceived need to assign some public stigma when children lag behind a common standard. New protocols were issued, sanctions followed. The network of teachers' colleges, state education departments, supervisory associations, grant-making bodies, and national media inoculated the learning system with these ideas, and local managers grew fearful of punishment for opposition. In 1962, an NIMH-sponsored report, The Role of Schools in Mental Health, stated unambiguously, quote, education does not mean teaching people to know. What then? It means teaching them to behave as they do not behave. Close quote. A clear echo of the Rockefeller Foundation's dream from an earlier part of the century. Schools were behavioral engineering plants. What remained was to convince kids and parents there was no place to hide. And I've been reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. Gatto was a former award-winning teacher. You can learn more about Gatto's work and also download this entire book for free online at his website, johntaylorgatto.com. That's G-A-T-T-O.com. And you can download an MP3 of this show and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers and other brave.